CliffCentral.com.
I choose a song like this and I'm like, I don't think anybody's going to want to hear this. And then Sia's like, oh, this is the first time I've heard the original. And I go, all right, that's not so bad.
And just like that, you have made Sia a better person.
Yeah, there we go. Steve Winwood with Valerie. Have you heard some kind of remix?
Yeah.
Okay.
With to
it. Right, okay.
What is a song on the 80s show that was played and Pinky and I both looked at each other and we were surprised that it was an actual song because we just...
Oh, Venus.
Yeah,
by
we
Bananarama.
Just know it from the commercial.
Got us on the mountaintop, yeah.
Yeah. I'm your Venus, I'm your power, your
fire,
desire.
Yeah,
that one. I just know from the commercial with
Sia,
the
Sia and
leggy
Pinky,
models
they
and then they shave themselves.
You guys thought that the song was written for the commercial.
Yes.
See, Pumi, this is what we're dealing with.
I was like, wow, this is quite extended.
So, yeah, you know,
the commercial.
You know, every conversation with you, there's no middle ground, right?
Oh, wow.
It either does one or the other.
Yeah.
The one, sometimes it makes me so happy to know that there are people out here living their best lives the way you are living your best life.
But.
And then on the other side, no but. But on the other side, Sia, you devastate me to the core at the level of like, what are you?
I'm sorry.
Read something. Read the internet. If not, just, you know.
Well, I'm sorry to disappoint you so.
He's like any of us. He's learning day by day from hearing things like the 80s show with Dory and,
yes.
and Paolo. So who knows? Hey, here's something interesting. On the interchange, can a merger of communism and capitalism create some kind of economic utopia? That's the latest question being tackled on the interchange. Ideologies like communism and socialism have seen a massive decline in popularity over the years and a huge body count. Countries like Venezuela are seen as the final nail in the coffin for those economic systems. On the other hand, global capitalism has taken a drastic knock, particularly after the 2008 global financial crisis, which left so many people financially destitute. So, would it be possible to take the best of both systems and create something even better? You can listen to The Interchange on cliffcentral.com, on our app, or wherever you get your podcasts. It's made possible by Absa and Simong. Take a listen today. Mm-hmm. So we got a couple of messages about this witchcraft and the cat. it seems Eddie says he's a white witch.
Oh,
yeah, boy.
And he uses positive white magic.
Yeah, boy.
Jameen says, I just passed four ways and I'm sure I saw Whiskers Chavalala in a yellow taxi northbound on the N1.
Please, laughing at this is just going to condone more messages like this. Please, let's just drop this.
Sia, there are people out here traumatized.
By a cat.
Traumatized.
So now I've been corrected as well. It's not a cat necessarily randomly driving this taxi. It's a cat inhabiting the driver of a taxi.
How do you know if that's happened?
So you see a driver stop the taxi. You get in. And then because now you're locked in as the taxi's moving, you can't go anywhere.
It transforms into a cat.
Yes, yes.
Is that like transgenderism?
I don't know.
Is that like a man gets in and then halfway through the trip, he's like, I'm actually a woman. I identify as a woman. Is that the same thing?
I just don't know.
All right. Pumi told me an interesting story about Benin. Listen to this, because superstition... as ridiculous as it is, can have a positive effect. It's like anything in the world. You can find the positive or the negative. But listen to this. Benin, which is a country here in Africa. It's on the west coast of Africa.
So, Oba of Benin invokes charms last exposed to sunlight 800 years ago against human traffickers.
In Benin, the main religion is voodoo.
Absolutely.
All right, so an Oba is like a... It's like a chief,
like,
traditional
yeah,
ruler.
Yeah, so this particular one is like second in command in the hierarchy. So he's pretty up there.
Right, he's an important Oba.
He's an important Oba.
Okay.
Right? And he's just like, you know, he's taking a stand against a problem that society has.
So this is human trafficking.
Human trafficking. And he is, and interestingly enough, as I was then Googling it, so I heard this. On an Al Jazeera interview with Wole Soyinka. because, like Wole Soyinka, you know, Nobel laureate, the man's not, he's not,
he's a well-known guy.
He's, you know, he's not like playing around. And and he was actually, and part of the reason why I listened so closely was he was explaining how religion and factionalism and what we see today, particularly in Africa, this growth of complete chaos is being hijacked. Is that the right word? Hijacked by populists using the very things that people believe in, whether true or not, in order to sweep through to power. We see this, right? With the EFF.
Sure. And we
see it with the EFF.
We even see it with like religious organizations in South Africa, and like pastors spraying doom in people's faces, and then they become very, you know, we've got like Shepherd Bushiri, who's been controversial at best.
Absolutely.
And these guys become very politically powerful.
And this for me was so fascinating, that even a thing, so for us over here in South Africa, it's so far-fetched for us that something like voodoo or curses could be used in this manner. But of course, I'm seeing this yesterday, the day after Whiskers Shabalala is trending.
Yeah.
It is Whiskers. I mean, okay. The city of Joburg was tweeting the ID. The driver's license, Whiskers' driver's license is apparently expired. But anyway.
So, you know, what
blew my mind about what was trending around the story of Whiskers is the number of people coming forward with their own stories of witchcraft, with their own stories of all sorts of what may sound to me as far-fetched, but in reality, isn't that the duality of life? Right?
Listen,
good and evil live, one can't live without the other. So if we're going to accept and believe that there are white witches who use the power of good, then
there must be evil ones.
The converse must be true. Yeah.
But I don't believe any of them exist. I'm sorry, Eddie, you're full of shit if you think you're a white witch. But let's just look at the story of that Wallace Inyika was telling you. So this Oba in Benin.
Who, by the way, just Google image him, please.
Google image
him. Put a picture of him on the...
outfits.
Wow.
Yeah, oh.
He looks like Whitney Houston and Michael Jackson in a music video. It's a hell of an outfit. Anyway, this guy calls a press conference on television. Is that right?
Yeah.
And says in this press conference, I hereby curse all the people publicly on television.
It's a press conference.
All the human traffickers. And what happens?
The right thing happens, because the positive response, right, is that it goes down.
Human trafficking goes down by 2/3 or something.
So, like, ridiculous. But hey.
It worked.
So can you then imagine the number of people who then feel that this guy has their best interests at heart, and he knows what to do to deal with the problem, with their social problem.
And he takes out these charms and he casts the spell.
How did he do it?
He's got these charms that haven't seen sunlight in what, how long?
It's like 800 years.
And he uses these to curse the human traffickers.
But
and
he solved the problem. An extent.
He cut down human trafficking by 2/3. And this is measurable in Benin.
I'm just saying, y'all.
Might be some value.
I'm just saying, y'all.
You got to do what you got to do, right?
It ain't all Harry Potter out here.
Mm-hmm. Maybe a very basic attitude to have, but I just think if I don't necessarily believe in it, but also at the same time, I don't want proof around me to see that it does exist. Just similarly,
leave me alone.
Yeah, leave me out of it. Even with ghosts, I'm not saying they don't exist, but I don't want to know if they do either. Don't talk to me. Don't come to me. Don't give me messages.
I've always said if you've got a haunted house, just sell it to an atheist. They don't really give a shit.
Well. Solve your problems. Moving
done,
on.
Yeah.
And that's it.
Yeah, it's very... Listen, hey, by the way, before I forget, Wouter Kellerman, you know who he is, the Grammy Award-winning flautist. He's going to be joining us this morning, along with the Ndlovu Youth Choir that made waves on popular reality competition show America's Got Talent. The award-winning flautist Wouter Kellerman has made South Africa proud yet again by winning the Best Independent Music Video
Hello,
at the Hollywood Music and Media Awards for their Zulu version of Ed Sheeran's Shape of You. How cool is that?
Mm.
So he's been in here before, but well done to him. And then we got a couple of interesting things. R. Kelly has made the news again. Have you heard about this?
Well, it's one of his girlfriends, his live-in girlfriends, that gained popularity a couple of months ago. Now, these were two women, they're like in their early 20s. And in the midst of all of these allegations and serious now court appearances taking place around R. Kelly, these two women were still saying, oh no, we love him, he's amazing, he can do no wrong. Yeah. Well, now the tide is turning because one of the women is now saying, okay, I'm going to be for real.
He's a monster.
Yeah.
R. Kelly's live-in girlfriend, who defended him amid sexual misconduct allegations, is now apparently calling him a monster and is saying she is also a victim turned survivor. On the crowdfunding website Patreon, a woman claiming to be Joycelyn Savage describes the singer as controlling and abusive. She also says Kelly got her pregnant twice, and just a warning, some of what she has to say is quite disturbing.
And she's raising money for herself. Surprise, surprise. She's on Patreon asking for people to give her money. So how honest are you? How much credibility do you have if you're also asking for money? That's always got to be the question. If someone is after some money, they're probably not telling the truth. But let's go.
So
with
far,
this.
Anyone has sympathy for her?
Not really. But then
we do know
R. Kelly. We do know R. Kelly is a monster. So why did it take her a while to come out with this? Because she was fine with the money he was giving her at the time to defend him.
Have y'all seen the documentary? Have you seen Jim Hapson's documentary?
Contamentary.
Dream Hampton's documentary.
Tell us.
Surviving R. Kelly.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
That was a while ago.
Yeah. This was from last year.
There was a new one. Okay.
Dude, it took me 12 months. I couldn't bring myself to view it. It took me 12 months to finally get over myself and watch the documentary. It is harrowing, to say the least. And it's on local, I think on Showmax or something, ETV. It's on local TV, so you can also watch it if you haven't seen it yet. But what I was astounded by, so there's a story of a girl and her mom who's been trying to get her out. Mm. And she eventually succeeds to kind of draw her out. And she runs away to go back
to R. Kelly.
Yeah. So I have a little bit of sympathy
like
for this girl.
Stockholm syndrome, right?
I do. I have a little bit for this girl that says maybe she, whatever psychological trauma goes with this kind of crazy life that they're obviously living. I can see how it can be difficult
to
survive it and walk away and come back.
Yeah, okay. She didn't go on to CBS this morning, this show that we're playing this from. She didn't go on there to say, here's the story. She goes onto Patreon to raise money for herself to tell her story. There's a slight difference.
American dream.
Okay, here she is. Let's listen to what she says. All right.
Do both of you all believe you're in love with him?
By the way, Gail has become the new agony aunt for America. When anyone wants to tell a story, they go to Gail. Okay? So Oprah's plan has worked.
Absolutely. Yes, absolutely.
Of course.
This was Joycelyn Savage in March when Gail sat down with her and R. Kelly's other live-in girlfriend, Azriel Clary, to speak about their relationship with the 52-year-old singer.
He's our full support and we're his full support. And all we need is each other.
But now, on the website Patreon, someone claiming to be Savage says Kelly is abusive and forced her to call him master or daddy. According to the post, when she didn't, Kelly grabbed her and choked her until she blacked out. CBS News has not been able to independently verify it's Savage making the posts. Savage, now 24, says she met Kelly when she was 19 years old and pursuing a music career. For years, she publicly defended him, including in this interview with TMZ.
I'm in a happy place with my life, and I'm not being brainwashed or anything like that. You know,
Savage now allegedly claims she was told what to say in that video and in others. She said a member of Kelly's staff starved her for days at a time until she learned her scripted lines word for word. She also claimed Kelly got her pregnant twice and she got an abortion both times. She wrote, "It's scary having your first child and aborting them because of some monster that kept me as a prisoner."
That's stupid! Use your common sense.
Kelly broadly denied allegations of abusing women in his interview with Gayle.
How stupid would it be for me to, with my crazy past and what I've been through, right now I just think I need to be a monster and hold girls against their will, chain them up in my basement, and don't let them eat.
The new accusations come as Kelly is in jail awaiting trial. He faces federal and state sex crimes charges, which include child pornography and allegations he recruited underage girls and women to have sex with him.
Jocelyn, if you do hear my message, please know that your mother loves you dearly.
Savage's family has begged her for several years to leave Kelly. This is what her father told Gayle in March.
A father, love will never change for his daughter.
What do you all have to say to R. Kelly?
Really?
Really.
He need to rot in jail.
Gerald wow. Griggs is the Savage family.
All right.
This thing is...
What a mess.
This thing is unbelievable on so many levels. But y'all know, like, I'm a big fan of true crime podcasts, right?
Mm-hmm.
I can tell you for free, this is the way that America... This is just the way the American cookie crumbles. That place is a proper shit show for the kind of madness that has been bred in America. I don't find it unreasonable at all that this girl would open a Patreon account and try and make money. This is how America works.
Well, I don't know, you're laying a lot of the blame at America's doorstep. Like, this is one insane human being, R. Kelly.
All I'm saying is...
And this chick is clearly, like, she's unstable as hell. I don't know that this is America's fault.
All I'm saying is that what happens in the water in America, but they seem to have a disproportionate number of crazy.
I don't think so. I think it's the most sensible country in the world, frankly.
Where's the crazy coming out of Switzerland?
Well, nobody asks. Nobody asks. No, I hear you. But then you take a country like Austria, which had old Joseph Fritzl. You know?
Right.
Oh, look,
there's crazy everywhere. But
there's just a lot more people in
the
America.
The American level of crazy, Gareth.
Everybody in America tells their story.
For money.
Sure.
So,
R. Kelly killed your app as you mentioned his story. see, this is happening. I'm telling you, we've got to get this app sorted out. That's from Sifrit. Sorry, we'll try to fix that. Speaking of populism. This is a message that's just come in from Kucho, who says, "Speaking of populism, you guys must watch the Bikram documentary on Netflix. Mind-blowing."
I saw that come up.
You did?
Yeah, I saw that come up, and I was just like, I really like Bikram. I like my Bikram.
That's yoga.
My 70 minutes, 90 minutes of Bikram yoga in the hot room. Yeah.
JD's on the line on Skype. You want to talk to JD? Hey, JD, what's
up?
Hey,
JD.
Hey, what's up, G? How you doing?
Cool. What's happening, man?
I'm good, 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 man. It's a Tuesday, very hot out here in Pretoria.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I wanted to actually ask Sis Pumi. Hi, Sis Pumi.
Hi.
Last week you mentioned the story of Colin Kaepernick.
Yes.
I feel like you left a lot of stuff out of that story. You were very one-sided on that story.
Yeah, I'm a fan.
Hey, I'm a fan for what he knelt for. But in this particular instance... I do feel like he stepped out in this one.
Mm.
Because first and foremost, you said that he sued the NFL. Yes, he did. He did not win. They settled. That's two different things.
Okay.
Settling means that you didn't get what you wanted, neither did I. All right? Mm-hmm. But that's semantics. And from what is believed to have been said, in that part of that settlement was that he was going to get a workout. The workout was given to him on the Tuesday that it's going to happen on a Saturday. All right. He had all that time. He didn't say anything about this contract or that waiver that he was being asked to sign. Now, I'm not saying that him signing the waiver was the right thing to do, but he had all that time to come out to the media and say, hey, look, these people are trying to make me sign my rights away. Why did he keep quiet for all that time? You only decide on that particular day, the Saturday, the workout is happening at 3:00. At 2:30, you tell them, I'm not coming. I'm going to go do my workout at another place. If Garrett Cliff has an interview for me, with some studio executives, and he says to me, it's on a particular day at this time. If I do not want to attend, I should tell him in advance. Why do I tell him half an hour before that time?
Kaepernick is a big attention seeker and not the best football player.
That's my point. I feel like he doesn't actually want to play.
No,
because you could have said it beforehand, I'm not going to come, I'm not happy with this waiver. Or show up to the place and say, I cannot go through with this, look at this waiver. Why do this thing? Because I'm looking at it as, you know, if I've got an interview at Cliff Central Studios, half an hour beforehand I say, you know what, come meet me at SABC Studios. He had the whole thing planned out. It was a publicity stunt.
Yeah, no, it was, and he was deliberately trying to sabotage them because this is all he's got. Unless he gets this noise, remember his whole career up to all the successful parts of his career up to now have been around controversy. So he's a controversy monger. He's a football player second.
Because you know, look, I'll give him this. He does have talent, but Pumi, if you as Canton likes to say. If you crunch the numbers and you look at his last, if you look at his last two seasons when he was actually playing, he was in a bit of decline. He was on the bench. He was no longer a starting quarterback. So if you crunch the numbers, so all right?
The thing for me is I think between the NFL and Colin Kaepernick, they're all locked in a mega chess game that's playing out in front of our eyes. And so for Kaepernick to make the decision, he did not make the decision on the day that he's going to move to the high school field.
But that's even worse.
He set that up before. No, it's not, because he's actually thought it through. So if they are in this chess game that we are all watching, each one of them, hold on.
Then why not say beforehand? Why not say beforehand?
Because if you are in a chess game, which is a game of strategy, you decide when to move, how to move, and what to move. And that's what he did. That's what he did. So now,
okay, but if you truly want to play,
so
if you look at it this way, because you are the one that compared him to Muhammad Ali.
I absolutely do.
Muhammad Ali said his boxing license was taken away from him. He said, I'm not going to fight in Vietnam, right?
Yes.
They gave him back his boxing license. He went back to box. He didn't strategically say, well, I'm not going to box here. I got my license. This is what I want. Now I'm going to go in there and I'm going to win. The legend of Muhammad Ali is mostly because when he came back,
the legend of Muhammad
Ali is because he actually won. Aside from the activism,
hold on.
Would Colin Kaepernick's message not be more powerful if he came back and he totally balled out?
Hold on, sir. The legend of Muhammad Ali, and I stand by my words from last week, same as Colin Kaepernick, we will not have the answer to whether he was right or wrong today. We need history to be on our side, which means all of this has to pass. All of this has to be down the line. Same as Muhammad Ali, even when he got his boxing license back, it was still a very divisive issue whether he does go back and fight. And I think that the unfortunate thing is you and I are having this conversation too soon in the game. So the game is not done. The game has not been lost or won. And that is what we need to wait for in order to be able to look back and say, well, This is what he was moving towards. These are the strategic moves that he put in place, and he lost or won. It's too soon to tell. But in my view, he and the NFL both are locked in a chess game, and each strategic move that each one of them makes puts the other in a position where what they do next is important.
Yeah.
I don't know. I just felt
it's
like
okay.
the issue also had passed. So that I feel like the NFL actually didn't need to do this for him. You know what I mean? I think it was something that was probably within that settlement that, you know what, we will give you a workout. And you got to ball out. And football is a tough game. So and then my last thing is that, you know, he has this antagonistic way about him. Now, I'm not saying whether that's right or wrong. But he showed up to his workout in a Kunta Kinte shirt.
Have you read The $40 Million Slave? Have you read that book about NFL and black players?
All right. No. What I'm saying is, if we truly know who Kunta Kinte was, and you're trying to invoke that spirit, Kunta Kinte is a slave that tried to run away 4 times.
Read the book, $40 million slaves.
They eventually cut off his foot because he kept trying to run away.
Yeah.
Why? If the NFL is the slave plantation, he's trying to run back.
Exactly. He's trying to run back to the plantation.
Exactly.
All right. So, listen, JD, this is good, but you and Pumi are going to have to carry this on another time. We've got a guest in here. All right. Thanks, man.
Thanks for calling, dude.
All right, very
crunch
good.
The numbers, Pumi.
Crunch the numbers. All right, JD taking on Pumi this morning. It's almost 7:30. I wanted to get him in here earlier, but he's here now. Our own pride and joy, the unbelievable Grammy Award-winning Voted Kalaman, who makes his return to Cliff Central this morning. How are you, Voted? Nice to see you.
Oh, yes, thank you. Very nice to see you. It's the crack of dawn for us musicians, you know.
Yeah, no, you guys
and the
don't
traffic
know.
Wasn't. I was like, Tulsi was driving, and I was like trying to catch an extra sleep on the back seat.
I'm sorry. There's no way you'd fit in the back seat.
But for you, I'll do it. For you, I'm here.
Do you fit in the back seat?
Not really.
How tall are you?
I'm 6'2".
Yeah, you see, you'd have to crunch up like.
I do, but I'm used to crunching up, you know, lots of flying.
Yeah.
And so I'm used to it. I'm pretty good at it.
So let me just pray-see this for everybody, because along with the Indlovu Youth Choir that made waves on the reality TV show America's Got Talent, you have made South Africa proud again. You've just won the Best Independent Music Video at the Hollywood Music in Media Awards for the Zulu version of Ed Sheeran's Shape of You, which you feature in very prominently. So congratulations,
thank
first.
Thank you. Thank
very
you.
Good news.
Yes, South Africans are killing it.
Y'all have saved 2019.
I know.
You have saved 2019. You guys don't understand. This year was like hell in a handbasket.
Really,
and here we
a
are.
Difficult year.
Winning on the world stages. Well done for bringing us back in the game.
Thank you.
Were you at the awards ceremony?
No, I couldn't. I couldn't make it. I had some gigs over here.
It was 6 days ago, right?
Yeah, it was on the 20th.
Do they send you the award in the post, or what do they do?
Yes, well, we got a friend of ours to accept the award.
Okay.
But, you know, they don't – it's like the Grammys, the same. They don't actually have the award ready for you because they haven't inscribed it.
Okay.
So they do that later, and then they post it.
So where do you put these awards? You got a place at home?
My Grammy is in a is in a box in the cupboard.
Oh, you're joking. Yeah. I would
is it like a display box, a glass box or something?
No,
I
haven't got around to it, so I must make a nice spot for everything, but I've been rushing around, and so my co-winner in India, Ricky Kesh, he's got, as you walk into the studio, there's this huge glass display
exactly.
on a beautiful wooden stand.
Oh, that's magic. And, so you've got to have that.
I have to.
Please,
I have to,
man,
yes,
don't let this be like pearls before a swine.
Yeah, exactly.
Show some appreciation, dog.
Yeah, no, I'm getting to it.
So the ceremony for the Hollywood Music and Media Awards took place in Avalon in California on the 20th of November, just 6 days ago. The awards celebrate a decade of recognizing the most exceptional music artists, songwriters, composers, and industry leaders in the music business. So it's a different kind of honor, this. This is very impressive.
Mm. Yes, and this is specifically for music and media. So it's about marrying music with a visual element.
Right.
So it's like scores for soundtracks for movies and that kind of thing. And so the independent music video is one of those awards.
So they love this. I'm just going to play a little bit of it for everybody to hear it. This is did this at Maboneng. I mean,
yes,
the Cradle.
Cradle of Humankind. Yeah.
Beautiful.
Don't mind me, but hey, I'll just play it up.
you with the flute.
The flute has all the bass elements and percussion as well.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Amazing. So who got together with who? How did this happen?
Well, actually what happened was we had to do a Nigerian artist asked us to do a collaboration, and he wanted a youthful choir as well. Mm-hmm. So Tulsi, my manager who's sitting here, went out looking for a choir, and she found the Ndlovu. They're from Mutsi in Limpopo. She found them.
Look at what you've done. Tulsi, just come and sit here quickly, because this is a big deal. This is you're not allowed to sit there on the sofa being quiet. This is amazing.
It's incredible.
So when you see what you've done, how are you?
Good, good.
Good. Listen, congratulations. I mean, I suppose we all owe you a debt of gratitude for how well they did at the America's Got Talent show, because if you hadn't discovered them...
Yeah, I suppose. I mean, I just fell in love with him.
Yeah, and then we did that collaboration. We both loved them. And then I thought, let's do something to see if we can broadcast their talents to the world.
Right.
And we did this collaboration quickly because we were so busy, but we just loved it. So we knew we had to do it. So
how long did it take you to put the music video together?
The long thing was the song, actually, to get that song. The arrangement. And because it was so difficult for me with the flute because they're so amazing that eventually I felt that it doesn't even need any
accompaniment.
So I had – it was a very nice – a very tricky balance – to get that right. But I think we did it well. And then the music video we shot, and we did a lot of to and fro with the editing.
Beautiful.
Eventually, we're so happy with how it turned out. Clive Morris did us a favor.
Really? Yeah.
And he did it for a fraction of the usual cost.
Amazing.
Because they also loved the whole project. We put it on my YouTube and Facebook, and it just went crazy. It went viral. Tens of millions of views very quickly. And then America's Got Talent got wind of it and scouted the choir to
amazing.
Come and enter.
Did they get hold of you guys to?
No, they sent Ndlovu an email, and the choir thought it was a hoax, and they just ignored it. And so the second email came, and they ignored it. Third email, they finally responded, and then they wanted to hear whether the choir can actually sing live. Because, many artists sound great in the studio with all the tuning.
Sure, of course.
But so they actually called them on WhatsApp and heard them live. And they loved him, and then that was it.
Well, there's a lesson for everybody. Reply to every email.
No. Verify the emails.
But I also did the same with Voter, because when somebody called me to say Voter's in the 2010 World Cup closing ceremony, I'm like, whatever. And then the minister's office called me and says, Tulsi, why are you giving these guys a hard time? Just sign the bloody contract.
So you didn't know it was for real?
No.
See, verify.
Yeah.
But tell me quickly, because your life is really, it's such a great story, because you weren't able to be a musician full time.
Yes.
At a certain stage.
Yes, I actually, when I left school, we didn't have money to study anything. And I wanted to study music, but I could get only way I could study is with a bursary. And so Anglo American offered me a bursary to study engineering.
Yeah.
So I studied engineering at UJ and enjoyed that as well, but my passion is still music. And after that, started working as an engineer, had kids early, and the expenses just mounted up.
Yeah.
And I you know what I'm talking about. And then I tried to swap over to music. Money ran out, went back to engineering. A couple of years later, the same thing. Carried on that way for 18 years, actually 20 years, until my daughter was finishing with university, my son was finishing school, and finally I could make that transition. And since then, I've been working like crazily, because I've been waiting so long, and it's been just a dream ride.
So, you talk about all of the hard work that went into putting the video together.
Yeah.
You talk about 18 years of wanting to, and this burning passion
exactly.
that you had.
Yeah.
In a world where, Instagram kind of makes us feel like, instant.
Yeah.
Everything is instant. How did you keep it burning for so long? What did you have to do in the internal work that you had to do to keep it burning and keep it alive and not give up? I mean, engineering pays well.
That's the thing. And still, I mean, I actually gave up a lot of money to do this music. It's cost me a fortune because I do make, I do earn well in music, but not as well as I would have. I had my own engineering company. So I had
damn,
to give up.
Life is so full of sacrifices.
Yeah. But I'm so happy because I'm financially fine and happy. So I'd rather be financially fine and happy than rich and unhappy. So,
I,
you know,
hear you.
For me, the, it was just a no, like, you know, a no-brainer. And I played music every day during my engineering days. Went overseas for master classes. Still did
so
everything.
So invested in it.
Yes,
as
and
well.
And just kept on loving it. So
Chelsea, what's it like to manage somebody like this? Because of
Grammy award winning.
Yeah.
Yeah, we started the journey together in 2005, 2006. We opened up our own company. It was quite funny when Voter came out with his first CD. We went to Universal, we went to Sony, we went to almost all the labels, and nobody even wanted to touch us.
Sure.
And then we just did our own marketing. And what's nice about Voter, he comes from the business world. So lots of research, and I come also from a corporate world too. So it's easy to work with him because he understands the branding, the marketing.
But of course, the problem everybody knows with Flautists, they all huge amounts of drugs and sex.
The whole life.
The most badly behaved people in music. Flautists are the worst.
So how?
Jethro Tull.
Yeah. That's quite funny. Ours is like green tea, lots of green juices,
yoga
exercise.
You know, that's all. And my funny. The strange thing is my whole band is like that. Nobody smokes, nobody drinks. But we get high on the music.
Do you think that because the success came later, you didn't get a chance to go and be crazy?
Yeah,
I
did my partying at the in my university days and
it was engineering students, hey?
They're usually very boring. But I wasn't like that. But, yeah, I know we grounded, and I think it helps, too, because we've worked so hard and so long, we're better equipped to deal with the successes. You know, if you do really well very early, it's actually not that good a thing. I think it's very hard to deal with. And that's where the Ndlovu Choir, they've done so well. These kids have just haven't put a foot wrong. And they've got a great management team that's helped them deal with these success. Because it can also go wrong. You know, if you have success early, as I've seen with so many people, can become very diva-ish and eventually, you know, sort of shoot themselves in in the foot.
Because it is still work.
Yeah, you still have to do the work and you have to put in the hard yards, yeah.
Well, I've just got to go through a couple of things here that people may or may not know already. You have 7 SAMAs. You've collaborated with artists from all over the world. You won the Grammy for Best New Age Album back in 2015 with Winds of Samsara, with the collaboration that you mentioned earlier. You also can beatbox using the flute, which people may or may not know. And your latest album, which is called In a Different Light, was released this year and is out on all the music platforms. So go and download that and pay for it, for God's sake. Yeah, you know, you heard what Voter.
Thank you.
He's got to pay for this band. He's got to travel all over the world. Wake up early and come and do stupid interviews with me. He's a busy
sleeping
man.
Sleeping in the backseat of the car.
Exactly.
Contorting his body into...
And I believe that Shape of You cover has had over 4 million views already. Amazing.
Yes, on YouTube for more than 4 million views. And we've put that also on the album, because the whole album is about taking well-known songs and putting it in a different light, like in this case. And on Facebook... for example, the Rwanda website on Facebook, they somehow got hold of this video illegally. They ripped it, put it on their website, and just on that, they've got more than 8 million views.
Oh, wow.
Social media was like over 25 or 30 million.
So it's been amazing that to see this just blow up.
Right, if only they hadn't ripped it and actually paid for it, that would be even better.
That would be better, yeah.
All right, well, listen, congratulations again on all your success, and we hope to see more and more incredible stuff from you. And all these collaborations, it's so superb.
Thank you so much. Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Magnificent.
Yeah,
well
Telsy, done.
Telsy,
congrats on having the best eye for talent in the business.
Thank you. And thank you for having us here.
Sure thing. Sure. Absolutely. It is time now for Blind History and our latest episode, episode 11 in season 2 of Blind History. It's time to look at the Duke of Wellington, Pumi.
In breaking news, a memoir written by the mistress of a famous politician has set tongues wagging as the salacious details of his affair with her become suddenly public. Could this mean the end of his career, which up to now has been exemplary, having served in the military at the highest rank and securing the most important victory of the century? Could this ugly affair spell the end of a glorious life of public service? The nation is divided.
This all too familiar story could have been broken yesterday, but it wasn't. The year is 1825, and this is the story of the Duke of Wellington, victor of Waterloo, and the vanquisher of Napoleon. The publisher thought he could blackmail Wellington and asked for money to stop the publication, to which the Duke replied famously, "Publish and be damned!" Blind History, we are going through the eras of some of the most interesting human historical stories and some of the most interesting individuals in human history. It's part of a series that I'm very, very pleased to say has won awards already, and we continue to win these awards. Blind History Season 2, and we're into one of the final episodes here. A guy called Arthur Wellesley, the first Duke of Wellington. Now, he wasn't born the first Duke of Wellington, but he was born to a reasonably well-off aristocratic family in Ireland, of all places. And Anthony Medera is here with me to talk about one of our favorite characters from history. He lived from about 1769 until about 1852, and what a full life.
An incredible character. I mean, he really did have a full life. Everybody knows him for war. Waterloo, more specifically, one battle. But if we look at his life, and when I've gone through his life, it's incredible. I mean, he was prime minister twice.
That's right.
A lot of people don't know that. He fought in India. That was his greatest battle, was actually in India. He really had a full life, and he looked like he was going to amount to nothing in the beginning. His mother thought, "Oh, what am I going to do with this guy?" So it was interesting. He was an incredible character.
He is most famous, as you say, for war, but the guy actually started off being completely unimpressive. He didn't seem to have very much intellectual rigor. He wasn't a great physical specimen. He didn't necessarily have a fighting spirit of any kind. And for a long time, as you rightly point out, his mother was concerned that he would amount to nothing. Somehow, somewhere in the middle, they were in Belgium, and she sent him off to school. He learned some French. He learned to play the violin, and he came back as a man. He learned to ride horses very well. And
yes, he became a fine rider, and he needed to be, because one of the finest generals ever on a horse was Napoleon.
Right.
So, I mean,
who would ultimately become his big enemy.
Correct.
Now, I mean, I read an interesting quote that comes from him about how I think he did admire Napoleon from a distance. I think the two had a kind of grudging respect for each other. But it was interesting that he didn't really enjoy war. Like, he was quite emotional about war. And there's that famous quote in a dispatch from Waterloo in 1815 where he said, "Nothing except a battle lost can be half so melancholy as a battle won."
Yeah, so he was traumatized. He absolutely didn't.
Apparently, after Waterloo, he didn't even want to speak to his men. He was crying after the battle because it was so bloody. And he made sure that King George IV eventually gave everyone a medal. Everyone, from the highest ranking officer to the lowest. And those Waterloo medals you can still find today, but they're quite rare.
It was a very close run battle. When you're fighting Napoleon, you don't get off easily. And also, he lost so many people in his personal regiment.
Circle.
And actually, people so close to him. And so many people died that day. Obviously, people would ask, "Oh, please take us to Waterloo. Give us a tour of the old battleground. What did you do? Why did you choose this place?" He refused to do it. And once he had to do it, the Prince Regent mentioned he had to do it, and he wept. He cried. He couldn't go through with it. He had a reasonably long career. He was 46 when he stopped after Waterloo, but he'd already been fighting since his early 20s in the army.
And as you say, in India and in the peninsula and all kinds of places.
Exactly. And India was really tough because he was sick a lot of the time. A lot of the Europeans were sick because they would struggle to get used to the climates and the environments and the food. So his big claim to fame was logistics, organizing, and patience. Now, what's always impressed me about the greats is the speed to battle. So Alexander's speed was phenomenal. Julius Caesar's speed was phenomenal. Napoleon's speed was phenomenal. Wellington wasn't that, but he was so successful. He never lost a battle. And he was very cautious and patient. And that's how he figured out what the other guys were doing. He would always choose a battleground, but make sure he's got logistics to support his troops.
Supply lines and all of defenses.
That.
And
a big part of that won the war. And he was also very gracious, and he never wanted to snub whoever he overthrew or won in battles as religion and their beliefs. That's what he learned in India. And the punitive measures they wanted to put against the French after Waterloo, he was very much against that.
So it's an interesting thing to read about these people now, because obviously the ideas at that time were very different to the ideas we have now, and he'd probably be considered like a very right-wing reactionary by today's standards. But he had some pretty interesting ideas, and even when he became prime minister later on, he emancipated the Catholics, which was very unpopular among some people in England. You know, he also was quite open about the ideas around that there should be two strong parties, that one party should not dominate. And he was quite clipped in his speech. Like, if he was looking for a solution to a problem, he would use as few words as possible. And I remember there was a story they told of the Great Exhibition, when he was walking through the Crystal Palace, which was obviously closed in with glass, and there were too many birds in there, and they were making a noise, and they were, you know, roosting in the trees. And the Queen, Victoria, at the time said, "You know, Lord Wellesley, how do we deal with this problem?" And he said, "Sparrowhawks, ma'am." Two words.
That's so true.
Yeah. So he had very powerful abilities to come to the best possible answer to a very complex question quickly. I suppose that makes for a good general.
Yeah, and discipline. Discipline, exactly. You can hear in that term, listen, we're not messing around. And he actually, in the beginning, early years, he thought very little of the British. And I mean, actually, the British didn't have a really good foot army.
Yeah.
They were strong with Lord Nelson. They were very, very strong on the sea. But with a foot soldier, he actually built this team. And he started with line formation. Because Napoleon in the beginning said, "Who's this idiot?"
Mm.
You know, I mean, I'm not worried about this. But in the end, the line formation took Napoleon out. That was really one of the main things in the great designs of Wellington's army, was lineage and line formation.
There was a very interesting story about him meeting Nelson. They only met once in the lobby of one of the armed forces buildings in London. And they met twice in that meeting. But the first time, Wellington's opinion of Nelson was not good, because Nelson came in and only spoke of himself. You know, he was already a famous admiral by then. He'd commanded victories all over the place. He was this celebrity for the age. And Wellington wasn't as well known yet at that point. And he said all that Nelson did was talk about himself. But then Nelson went out of the room, asked someone who Wellington was, came back in because suddenly he knew this was a man of gravity. And the two of them had what afterwards both referred to as the most interesting conversation they've ever had in their lives. So it just shows you, your first impression isn't always the right one.
I'd love to be a fly on the wall.
Can
with
you
that.
Imagine?
Those are the two greatest military men, you know, probably in history, some of the greatest military men in history.
The two of them and their victories set up the British Empire.
They did.
It's sad that he had a miserable personal life. I mean, he fell in love with this girl called Kitty Pakenham, who was the daughter of a Viscount, and her brother didn't think that Wellington, at the age that he wanted to marry her, was a good enough match. And she, you know, she was obviously not available to him then, so he was turned down. And he took it very personally.
He broke his violin.
He burnt a whole lot of his stuff. He really had a temper tantrum about it.
If only he could look into the future, he would have kept the violin.
and he ended up joining the military as a result of that, because he gave up on music and everything else that he cared about. So maybe Kitty's brother did us a favor in the long run. He did eventually get to marry her once he proved himself to be someone of substance. And it wasn't a happy marriage.
No, he was very disappointed when he reconnected with her. But he still went through with it. I don't know how I'm supposed to look at that. But he went through with the marriage. I think he wanted somebody with stature to sit next to him. But she was an introvert. And he loved the limelight.
Yeah, and he had many lovers.
Correct.
And he had some children with some of these lovers.
I don't think it was that bad.
No,
I mean.
But he did say the marriage was unsatisfactory.
Correct, yes.
Which is a hell of a way to say yeah, it didn't work out. Yeah. But they spent a lot of time apart as well. You know, he was obviously campaigning a lot of the time. Yeah.
Probably 80% apart.
Yeah, and she was at home getting more and more depressed.
But they both loved children. He was brilliant with children, and she also loved children. The kids used to jump all over him and climb all over him. He was away in the Iberian War. He was away for 5 years. So he didn't see his children for 5 years. They were one and two or something, and then when he came back, they were 5 and 7.
Oh, yeah?
So that was very interesting. But he really loved the children, and then they adopted a whole lot of other children. That was one thing that they had in common.
Huh.
But that was the only thing they had in common.
Well, he was eventually rewarded by the government, made Duke of Wellington, and he had military honors from all over the world. This is probably just post-Waterloo, which was obviously his greatest victory, his most famous victory, certainly. And he was buried eventually in St. Paul's Cathedral. Great pomp, the last heraldic state funeral in English history. And his name continues to be one of the great military names of Europe.
A million people turned up for that funeral.
That's phenomenal. And he's also regarded as having been a very strange man from a personality point of view. He had two servants who were loyal to him right to the end, a German called Beckermann and his valet, which is a guy called James Kendall. And they served him for 25 years, and they were both by his side when he died. There was a story that he never spoke to his servants. He would just write notes to them. But that was actually true for his grandson, not for him.
Oh, really?
Just never spoke to the servants. Just wrote notes, and they would do what was written in the notes. It's quite bizarre.
And then also during the funeral, never one to give up an opportunity to be more depressed, Queen Victoria wept.
Oh, which, you know, yeah, again, she liked to be sad.
She liked to be sad.
You still don't like her. She enjoyed being sad.
But he was fundamental in building her empire.
Absolutely. And the guy was also, you know, he struggled with some health problems. But his biggest, I think, disappointment in later life was that he'd stood next to an explosion. He was master of the ordnance for a while, which was like the head of ammunitions or munitions. And a big explosion went off next to him and really deteriorated dramatically the ability for him to hear in one of his ears. And he went for an operation, and in those days they didn't know what they were doing, and the operation left him even deafer. And it really didn't please him to be deaf. So if you spoke to him, you'd have to shout to him from the one side.
And also, I mean, when he was in Parliament, it was very, very difficult because he couldn't hear in Parliament. It became quite a challenge for him in the end.
Yeah, he was never quite well afterwards, is what they said.
Okay. Yeah. So I can imagine it has quite
But he had, as you mentioned earlier, a vigorous sexual appetite and had amorous liaisons during his marriage, enjoyed the company of intellectual and attractive women for many decades, and especially after the Battle of Waterloo, because obviously these women would gather around and say, oh, Lord Wellington, tell us about your battles. And then he'd say to them, well, I'll tell you about the battles a little later.
But interestingly enough, he shared two of Napoleon's ladies.
Oh, really?
Napoleon and Wellington really enjoyed that part of life.
Wow. And imagine the stories those women could tell.
I mean, they should have actually been friends, you know? But a point that I found incredible was Napoleon, he was expelled to Elba, and then he broke free from Elba. It's incredible how the army came down to, this was as Wellington's came across from the Iberian War.
Mm-hmm.
And basically taking Paris. As they got to Paris, they installed the Bourbon King again. And I think it was Louis XVIII.
And he ran like a
And he and like Napoleon child. Came back, and they saw the emperor, and they just went to their knees and said, we will back you again.
Hmm.
And that's really where Wellington came. Because after the Iberian War, he went back to England. He was by then very famous. And he went back to England, but what was he going to do next? They were going to ship him up to Canada, and he said, no, I'm not doing that. Europe's where things are going to happen. And then Napoleon regrouped. This was an incredible sight because they said, okay, there's only one man that can take on Napoleon. The Allied forces declared war on Napoleon, or coalition forces. War on Napoleon, not on France.
Right.
And he was having a ball in Belgium. Then what happened was Napoleon said, he knew there was a coalition, so what he's going to do is he's going to hit them while they were still separated. So he's going to hit the English, and he did that. And he actually won the day before he won a decisive battle while Wellington was at a ball. And he said, God damn, I've been humbugged. Napoleon's humbugged me. He left immediately, and within 6 hours or something, he was on the battlefields, and that the next day was Waterloo. It's an incredible story.
Well, apparently, when we talk about these women that they obviously were both had a voracious appetite for, apparently there was a publisher who tried to extort money out of Wellington once because they had the story of this mistress of his.
Correct.
And they were going to publish. And he said, publish and be damned.
Correct. He did say that.
And just, you know, said to them, go for it. Knock yourselves out. You can't. You will not extort money out of me. I will not be blackmailed.
But he enjoyed gambling and lots of different bed partners. But the one good thing about it was he was discreet. So that's what they said. Although everybody knew, at least he was discreet.
Yeah. I mean, you know, that was the way a lot of men behaved in those days. You're not going to make excuses for them.
No, exactly.
But he seems to me to have been a really interesting guy. And I assume also he spoke perfect French, by the way. And you know, as we said, there was this begrudging respect between him and Napoleon. And when two titans occupy the same period of time, you're bound to have really interesting stories. And did they ever meet? They must have.
Well, he saw the emperor. So he saw Napoleon, because what happened was when it was done for Napoleon, Napoleon put his best troops together and they formed a square in the middle of the battlefield at Waterloo. And Wellington was part of the regiment that was coming forward now to attack. And that's when he saw Napoleon. It was the last time he saw Napoleon because then Napoleon managed to get away. And he was away for a month and then they finally caught him and they sent him as far as possible away from Europe. So I think possibly he saw him once.
Wow.
But incredible on the battlefield, and they're both on horses. It's just in today's age, you do not see that. You do not see generals like that.
Everything's at a distance.
Everything's at a distance. Well, it's on a board.
Yeah. Well, the Duke of Wellington's house, which is in England, and was a gift from the Queen, just like Blenheim Palace was a gift from Queen Anne to Marlborough for winning against Louis XIV, that house actually belongs to the Queen, but every year the current Duke of Wellington and obviously every Duke before him has to send her a little flag, a little French flag, a tricolour, which marks, obviously, on the date of the Battle of Waterloo, the day that their ancestor, the original Duke of Wellington, the guy we're talking about now, defeated Napoleon. And that's his rent for the house for the year.
Sure.
That little flag. And it hangs up in Windsor Castle, and there's a new one every year.
And that's an incredible story behind that. And then how many pubs? 90 pubs? The Wellington, the Duke, the Wellington Arms.
That's right.
It's all named
And often. Cities all over the world, and streets, and high Correct. Schools, and opera houses and all kinds of things that have been named after him. So there's an interesting story about the Duke of Wellington. After one of the famous battles, one of the soldiers who'd fought alongside him was invited to have dinner with him that night, and he was boasting to his friends in his tent, and he said, tonight I'm going to go and have dinner with Wellington. The Duke of Wellington was there behind him while he was saying this, and he turned round and he saw him, and he said, oh, sorry, my lord and general. And he said, no, I'd just prefer if you'd show a little bit of respect and call me mister. And he said, my lord, they don't call Alexander, whatever his surname was, or Julius Caesar, whatever his surname was. They just have one name for them. That's the same for you. Use just Wellington.
Brilliant.
Amazing. Phenomenal. Amazing guy. So the Duke of Wellington, Arthur Wellesley. Thanks for listening to the award-winning Blind History, brought to you by Taylor Blinds and Shutters. CliffCentral.com